Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from our studio in the heart of the 561 West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by our Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief, John Kennedy.
Hello, George.
And rejoining the podcast this week, the Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor, Zach Anderson.
Hey, George, good to be back.
And you may be saying you're stacking that Jenga tower very high. You might want to back off, but not us. We're going to go even higher because we have in the studio very special guest, Palm Beach Post staff writer Chelsea Todaro is with us.
Hi, George.
All right. Glad to have you with us. Well, election season is over in Florida, and Trump season has begun. The president has resumed his regular visits to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, and Chelsea's going to give us a firsthand account of that a little bit later, of his Thanksgiving there. Also, we are less than 6 weeks away from Ron DeSantis taking the oath as the new governor of Florida. John Kennedy and Zach Anderson are going to fill us in on what to expect in Tallahassee from the DeSantis administration and the new legislature that's coming in. And, you know, as the DeSantis era begins, another one is ending in Florida. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson, who narrowly lost his reelection bid to Republican Governor Rick Scott, has begun his farewell, issuing some parting words. We're going to talk about that. And you know, with Nelson gone, the only elected statewide Democrat in Florida is going to be the new Agriculture Commissioner, Nikki Fried. And there is already a battle brewing over whether Nikki Fried's office will continue to have control over concealed weapons permits. John Kennedy is going to give us the scoop on that. And finally, there are 67 different county GOP chairs in Florida, but Zach Anderson is going to explain why the departure of one of them will have a big statewide impact. All that's coming up. But first, I believe I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music playing. Zach Anderson, what does that music mean?
That means it's time for our famous Pick a Number segment.
That's right. That's the segment on the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and later on we explain what that number means in Florida politics. Zach, why don't you go first? What number do you have for us today?
George, I'm going with an 82 today.
Zach Anderson with an 82. Now, as always, if you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery, we encourage podcast listeners to take notes during the Pick a Number segment. So, note takers, Zach Anderson, 82. John Kennedy, what number do you have for us today?
George, I'm here with a 39.
39. Okay. That's kind of close to my number. George Bennett, that's me. I am putting forward a 38 this week. And our special guest, Chelsea Todaro, we're going to put her on the spot. Do you have a number for us?
Yes, I do. I'm going to go with a much lower number, and that would be 11.
11. Okay. Another Spinal Tap fan is with us here in the studio. So, again, note takers, we'll go in reverse order here. Kind of interesting that numbers went in descending order. So, again, as you note takers know, the number 11 put forward by our special guest, Chelsea Todaro. George Bennett, that's me. I had a 38. John Kennedy with a 39. And Zach Anderson, the curve buster today, with an 82. You want to hang on to those numbers. And later on in the podcast, we'll explain what they mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our loaded lineup. As I mentioned, President Donald Trump returned to Mar-a-Lago and likely over the next several months will be making several visits to Florida, very important state for him. And Chelsea Todaro, the reason we have her here today, Chelsea spent a portion of Thanksgiving at Mar-a-Lago, and she's going to give us a firsthand account of that. And before she takes the microphone, as is our custom with all guests on the podcast, we welcome them with our royalty-free surf music. So, Chelsea, Thanksgiving Day, set the scene for us. You know, when the president is at Mar-a-Lago, normally he spends a lot of time golfing, and the media doesn't really have a lot of access to him. But Thanksgiving Day was an exception this year. Tell us a little bit about what went on Thanksgiving Day at Mar-a-Lago.
So when we first arrived to Mar-a-Lago, we were just expecting to see him make phone calls to the leaders of the military. He spoke to each branch. It was a good hour waiting in the press van. And then they finally took us out, and we walked I guess, to the main entrance. And when you're walking through it, there's these beautiful open fields. You know, there's like a tennis area, a running area. It's beautiful. And then you're walking to the door and it looks like a palace. It's stone walls, beautiful statues. I mean, you think you're walking into some type of royal home.
Right.
We're walking in and I'm kind of expecting, you know, us being a little far away from the president because, you know, he's the president.
Sure.
You know, they want their clear distance. But we walk in and as I'm walking in, you know, I'm just taking videos of like, you know, here's the inside of Mar-a-Lago. And by the time I'm taking this video, we walk in and the president's right there in the lobby. He's sitting. He has his desk. He's sitting and he's already on the phone. And we're able to get really close to him, about 10 feet.
And that's because you've been, wanded and fully swept and before you ever get that close to him, right?
Oh, so yes. We were fully swept with the Secret Service, the dog sniffing all of our belongings.
You always get a good wanding at Mar-a-Lago. That's okay. So there you are. And the president on Thanksgiving makes these calls to the different branches of the military on Thanksgiving.
He spoke to a leader from the 5 branches.
Okay. And the media gets to come in and see that. And that's, you know, that's pretty interesting. More access than we usually get when he's down here. And is that it?
No, I mean, it was very surprising. You know, it was a pretty long phone call. He was on the phone for about 30 minutes. And it's funny because it seems that he was on speakerphone, but the rest of us in the room couldn't really hear on the other line. So we were just listening to what Trump was saying.
Right.
So we were a little confused on like, you know, what he was really talking about. And we really thought it was just going to be the phone call and that was going to be it. And, you know, he was going to hang up, you know, and then we'd just be swept out of Mar-a-Lago. You know, I will admit I was a little distracted during his phone call with just how beautiful the room is.
I mean,
it's marble flooring. There's gold plated walls. There's a giant chandelier hanging over him. It's a beautiful room.
Wow.
It's just you can see why he brought the president of China from there about a year ago.
Sure.
So once he finished the phone call, you know, we thought that was it and we were going to walk out. But he was calm, composed, sitting there and he just opened the floor for questions.
Being the ace reporter that you are, you piped up with a question. Were you the first person to ask him a question?
No, I wasn't. You know, there was a couple of reporters, one from The Washington Post and another from The New York Times. You know, they started with the questions, you know,
Beltway media.
Yes. And, you know, they do this thing all the time where they ask him questions. I think Trump knew one of the reporters by name already. So they were asking questions and, you know, I knew I had to represent the Post. I'm like, you know, I have to shout out a question for him. So I think within like 10, 15 minutes in, there was finally like a 2-second pause. And I just went for it and just shouted it out because you weren't raising your hand or anything. You kind of just jumped out with questions.
So let's Joe Forzano, I think you might have some of that audio for us. Let's hear Chelsea Todaro's question to the President of the United States and his answer to it.
Mr. President, are there any updates on the troops that are being sent to the border in regards to the caravan?
No troops. We're going to have a strong border. Our southern border is going to be very strong. You heard me speaking to some of the folks just now in different parts of the world, and they're so proud of the job they're doing. And you got to have borders. If you don't have borders, you don't have a country. I mean, the Democrats want open borders, and they want these people coming in. Many of those people are criminals, okay, and have been so adjudged. We know who they are. They have records. They have some very substantial criminal records, some very bad criminal records. They're in the caravan. You saw what happened in Tijuana, where a number of the people said, these are tough people. They start fighting. They're starting fist fights. They have fist fights all over the streets. They're starting fist fights. They said, these are not like normal, innocent people. These are people you talk to them and they start a fist fight. I don't want that in this country.
There you go. Donald Trump, President of the United States, answering a question from Palm Beach Post staff writer Chelsea Todaro. Now, this was a couple days before it really boiled over with the at San Diego.
Yes, I heard there was tear gas near the border.
I believe that was from border agents rather than the any troops that had been sent there.
Yes. But, yeah. Unfortunately, he didn't fully answer my question. You know, I was hoping for him to give me updates on, you know, how many troops were there, or if he was sending more. But after that segment, then I think a reporter from the Associated Press followed up, you know, if he would use force,
right.
if he would give the okay to use force. And he said, you know, yeah, we would, you know, if Mexico can't keep control of it. And he said, you know, I hope we don't have to. But then what happened recently, it seems that it's already happening.
There you go. And so the Palm Beach Post, again, right on top of the news and with President Donald Trump on the border while he's here. Now, that was not the only time it turned out that the Palm Beach Post caught the president's attention during his trip here. When he arrived on a Tuesday night and the following night, Wednesday, the Thanksgiving Eve, the president had a tweet that said, you just can't win with the fake news media. A big story today is that because I have pushed so hard and gotten gasoline prices so low, more people are driving, and I have caused traffic jams throughout our great nation. Sorry, everyone. Those of us, you know, any reporter, if you cover the president, you follow his tweets. And I saw that one and I was like, oh, I wonder what he's talking about there. Well, it turns out a few days later in an interview with The Washington Post back when he was back in D.C., the president said that this report of him being blamed for traffic jams, that he read it in the Palm Beach Post. And those of us at the Palm Beach Post were kind of scratching our heads. I don't remember covering that. Well, it turns out on he arrived, as I said, on a Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So in the next day's print edition of the Palm Beach Post, Wednesday morning, there's a front page with a big picture of the president and First Lady Melania Trump arriving at Palm Beach International Airport. A nice Richard Graulich photo, if you want to check that out online. And a story by yours truly about the president arriving. And but down below it on the front page is a story by Sir Charles Elmore, one of our fine reporters here. And it says, low gas prices may cause heaviest traffic since 05. And it's just one of these standard holiday traffic stories that we run before every Thanksgiving, and in which a guy from the AAA said gas prices are a lot lower than they've been for a long time. But they're also expecting a record number of motorists out on the road. The story does not mention President Trump, but somehow he interpreted that as blaming him for traffic jams. So there you go. A little insight into, the one thing I took from it is that President Trump reads the Palm Beach Post.
So. Well, that's great. Is he a subscriber?
That's a good question. I don't know. I you know, we try to keep the editorial and business ends separate, so I don't know if it would be ethical for us to check that out. The president, though, wrapped up, what will be likely the beginning of several months of visits to Mar-a-Lago, and the Palm Beach Post and Gatehouse Media will be on top of that throughout the season. So you'll want to check that out. But moving on, the Ron DeSantis will be becoming governor in a few weeks, taking the oath of office. And John Kennedy, he's already started to make some moves with his transition. Can you fill us in a little bit on that?
Yeah, George, the DeSantis administration is very slowly taking shape. His advisors are working out of a 16th floor office at the state capitol. A notable insider name that has been announced just this week is Chief of Staff Shane Strum. Lately, he's been a senior vice president with Memorial Healthcare System in Broward County. But he's formerly a chief of staff for former Governor Charlie Crist, back when Crist was a Republican. Now, it's kind of interesting that DeSantis has turned to Strum, because Crist, of course, is reviled by many Republicans, apparently including DeSantis. Crist switched sides and became a Democratic congressman. And in the last couple of weeks of the governor's race, DeSantis campaigned in Crist's home, Pinellas County. And there, DeSantis said people had a chance for a mulligan by supporting him over Crist, who they still voted for overwhelmingly in 2014 when he ran for governor again, this time as a Democrat. So DeSantis was urging them to do a do-over. But Strum, I mean, all told, he's seen as he's a loyal Republican. He's efficient and somebody who has done this job, and that's a skill that's needed on the DeSantis side for a governor-elect. Remember, you know, he's a former congressman from south of Jacksonville, but he has no real experience in running, the $80 billion operation of state government. So Strum does. And he's a kind of nose to the grindstone administrator, and that should help. Plenty more administrators and office personnel are going to be needed to round out this administration. You know, the boss is getting sworn in on January 8th. He'll have a little bit of help. He's got, you know, newly elected House Speaker Jose Oliva is one of the early endorsers of DeSantis. Back when it looked like DeSantis had little chance over the establishment favorite, that was Adam Putnam, who now is the state's outgoing agriculture commissioner. So Oliva is going to be, you know, a likely help to DeSantis in state government.
You know, Republicans have run Tallahassee for 20 years. We've had Republican governors and a Republican legislature. But as history has shown, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody is always on the same page and in harmony. Can you give us an idea of how the legislature is taking shape and what kind of posture they're going to have with regard to Governor-elect DeSantis?
Yeah, the new leaders, they have a one-day organizational session held Thanksgiving week, and they didn't make too much news. But Oliva and Senate President Bill Galvano both command, you know, sizable Republican majorities in their chambers. So if anything, the drama is going to be any kind of intra-party struggles or some of these getting to know you differences with the new governor. Galvano, in his sort of opening interchanges with the legislature, he stuck mostly to niceties about putting the campaign season behind him, looking to for legislators to sort of help unite Florida. Oliva had a few more ideological signals. He was warning about the need to rein in Medicaid costs and reducing the size of government. Those are things, you know, few Republicans would say no to, including DeSantis. It's sort of the first song in a, you know, it's going to be a long dance. You know, what one, you know, somewhat poignant note maybe for Democrats in this legislature. In the House, the 47 members that they have in the 120 member House is actually a high watermark for this party this century, but it matches the number that they had in 1998. Of course, that was the last time they had one of their own in the governor's mansion as well. And many thought that this was going to be the year that, you know, this Washington generals like losing streak was going to be broken by the Democrats with the election of who they thought was going to be Democratic Governor Andrew Gillum.
Does that make DeSantis like Meadowlark Lemon? I'm not sure. So Bill Galvano, the Senate president, Jack Anderson, you've covered him some. Can you give us a little insight into him and to what we can expect in the upcoming session from Senate President Galvano?
Yeah, Galvano has probably been there the longest of any of these leaders. DeSantis obviously is just arriving. Oliva's been there for a few years, but Galvano, he was in the House for 8 years before he moved over to the Senate in 2012. He's a savvy political operator, understated, really kind of laid back, calm, doesn't get his feathers ruffled too much, but very astute behind the scenes at counting votes and knowing who he needs to placate to get what he wants accomplished. You know, he's known for tackling complicated issues like gambling. You know, last year he shepherded through the big school safety bill that was a very complicated bill to get passed. It had elements of it that appealed to conservatives, elements that appealed to, you know, Democrats and liberals. And he was able to navigate those competing interests and get really a bipartisan bill that was really kind of unusual, but rose to the occasion and did something after the Parkland shooting. So he's been able to move some big legislation through. And I think that, you know, he'll be one of the more steadying influences on the process. There's always a period of adjustment when you have a new governor and new leaders in the legislature taking over. And I think that's probably even more so with somebody like DeSantis, who a lot of these lawmakers really did not know much about before he ran for governor. He was kind of a loner in Congress. He wasn't somebody who was really, you know, networking a lot with a lot of the other movers and shakers in the state. So, you know, I think there will be sort of a getting to know you period. But when you have veteran hands like Galvano in there, I think that'll maybe smooth things out a little bit. But one party control is no guarantee of harmony. Even though Republicans have controlled the legislature for two decades now, there were some rocky periods under Rick Scott, who was a lot like DeSantis, kind of came came in as an outsider, shaking things up, said that he was going to take on the establishment, and ended up butting heads with lawmakers quite a bit. You know, even though Republicans controlled the legislature and there was a Republican in the governor's office, they went into overtime multiple times, had to extend the session, most notably over Medicaid expansion, when you had a more moderate leaning Senate pushing Medicaid expansion, and Rick Scott got behind Medicaid expansion, but the House refused to go along, and they fought over that for a long time. You could see something like that happen. You know, DeSantis has some ideas that could meet resistance. He's talking about environmental regulations. He was very out front on the problems with Lake Okeechobee and red tide. And, you know, environmental regulation is not really something that the Republican legislature has been too keen on. He's also talking about E-Verify and cracking down on businesses hiring illegal immigrants. That has met some resistance in the past. So could be very interesting to see how the dynamic plays out with these new leaders coming in.
So even with one party rule, there's plenty of potential flashpoints. So let me ask you this. You mentioned DeSantis's kind of anti-establishment reputation, and I know he even used the phrase drain the swamp a few times, referring to Tallahassee. Is that really happening, though, so far, John, in terms of the transition?
Well, it looks very much like business as usual here, where you've seen DeSantis turning to familiar names for his inaugural committee, for example. It's going to be chaired by mega lobbyist Brian Ballard, who also represents Donald Trump's business interests in Florida. Ballard is a longtime major fundraiser and kind of a well influential lobbyist in this town and also in Washington now. DeSantis's economic advisors that he also just recently announced, it's mostly a long list of really well-heeled Florida business types in most cases. It's led by former House Speaker Will Weatherford and includes Weatherford's father-in-law, another ex-House Speaker, Alan Benz. Most people who represent the sort of a Tallahassee, a dirt track version of the Washington deep state. But, you know, it really makes you wonder, you know, what happened to all that talk about DeSantis draining the swamp in Tallahassee?
Yeah, you wonder about that. So, well, now he's in the swamp. One other Tallahassee thing I wanted to get to real quickly. John, you had a story, you know, the only Democrat in statewide elected Democrat now is going to be Nikki Fried, who won a very close race for agriculture commissioner, and the ag commissioner, among the many functions of that office, is overseeing concealed weapons permits. What's the status of that? She's a big gun control advocate. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, she's a Broward County Democrat, you know, from the county that was the home to the, you know, horrible Parkland school shooting back in February. It has been outspoken about trying to impose more limits on guns in the state. And right now she's in an early scuffle with the National Rifle Association. She and a couple of Senate Democrats want to move the state's concealed weapons licensing program out from her office and over to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which is they see as a nonpartisan agency that already is charged with doing the background checks on applicants for these licenses. Florida has more than 2 million concealed weapons licenses. That's the most in the nation, and a stat that, you know, basically represents about 1 in 10 Floridians with a concealed weapons license. The NRA, though, wants to keep the program under an elected official, and specifically a Republican elected official, Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis, the NRA lobbyist Marion Hammer, who carries a lot of juice in the Republican-dominated state government. She says that provides better accountability than an agency like FDLE. But some say it also gives the NRA an elected official that it can pressure to assure that there's no slowdowns or any kind of obstacles put in front of the weapons program. Outgoing the Ag Commissioner, we mentioned Adam Putnam. You know, he caught a lot of heat last year after news reports showed that his office had failed to properly complete the background checks on more than 300, on a number of licenses, and more than 300 of them had to be revoked. And that forced the call for Fried and the Democrats to want these changes to try to improve efficiency, they say. It's an interesting early test that's going to see if Fried, as this isolated Democrat, can get anything she wants from the Republican legislature. And it also may be it may amount to the only real gun issue that gets any attention from the legislature, which is still wary of doing anything that would cross the NRA, even after the demands for stricter gun control following the Valentine's Day slaughter at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, became such a focal point and such a campaign issue throughout this past year.
And just the fact that they're already talking about this shows the power of Marion Hammer, who's kind of a legendary figure in Florida and around the country, and really transformed Florida into this sort of experimental gun rights state and pushing all these policies like Stand Your Ground and things that have become controversial. And, you know, she doesn't want if she doesn't want it, it's likely that the legislature will give very serious consideration to not having the Ag Commissioner office do these concealed weapons permits anymore. You know, Matt Gaetz, the conservative lawmaker who is guiding Ron DeSantis, his transition, said in a New Yorker article not that long ago that if you're with Marion 95% of the time, you're a damn traitor. It just shows the fear that she inspires in Republican lawmakers and the influence that she carries with this very important voting bloc that is the NRA. So I would be shocked if lawmakers didn't give this serious consideration. And I think that, John, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the reason that concealed weapons permitting is in the Ag Commissioner office, which is an unusual place to have it, and I think Florida is the only state that has the Agriculture Commissioner doing this, is because Marion Hammer wanted it there. She moved it from another office, so she tends to get what she wants.
That'll definitely be something to watch in the new session. And, you know, so Nikki Fried, as we mentioned, will be the only statewide elected Democrat in Florida. That's because Senator Bill Nelson, who has been the only statewide elected Democrat, lost his reelection bid to Rick Scott. Very close race, about 10,000 votes ended up separating him out of more than 8 million cast. And Nelson has begun kind of the long farewell. He's promised a series of farewell speeches from the Senate floor, and he gave the first of them this week. Joe Forzano is going to cue up a little clip from Senator Nelson's first farewell speech.
There's been a gathering darkness in our politics in recent years. My hope today can be found in the words of John F. Kennedy, who said, "Civility can guide us through that darkness to a safe and sane future." Thank you all for the privilege of a lifetime of public service. God bless you, and God bless our country.
There you go. And there was there will be more Nelson farewell remarks. I thought I want to play one clip from what turned out to be the only debate between Nelson and Scott was the Telemundo debate in early October. And we played part of this clip once before on the podcast. But I want to play this because Rick Scott, you know, Bill Nelson has held a variety of public offices since the early 70s. And Rick Scott's and he's been in the Senate for 18 years. And Rick Scott's campaign repeatedly hammered him as basically a do-nothing senator. He called him an empty suit. You know, been there too long and it's time for a change. That was kind of the theme of Rick Scott's campaign. At this Telemundo debate, Bill Nelson started to address that issue and talk about what his accomplishments had been. And I want to play this clip and just kind of how it played out, because I think it's very telling about the whole Senate race. Go ahead and cue that one up for us, Joe.
He says, "I don't do anything." Well, why don't you go to the beach, look out there and see if you see any oil rigs. Go to the Cape and the Space Center.
But what would you do to level the income in Florida?
What I would do is raise the minimum wage to $12 at least, if not $15, to raise the income level so people can pay for the necessities of life and feed their families.
Thank you so much, Senator. How would you answer to that, Governor Scott?
I think this is an example of why we need term limits. Senator Nelson has been there. He's had 42 years to do something about this.
That clip to me is just very telling on a number of levels. First of all, Bill Nelson starts to talk about his accomplishments and gets interrupted by the moderator. You know, like any debate, the two of them frequently wandered off topic, and there was some question about income inequality, I believe. And so he starts talking about, you know, summing up his career in Washington. And the moderator says, you know, well, what about this question? He gives this answer about raising the minimum wage. And then Rick Scott answers, well, this is why we need term limits. You've been there a long time and haven't done anything, which is kind of the you know, repeated theme of Rick Scott's campaign. So I think that was just kind of a telling exchange on a couple different levels. Getting to the substance of what Nelson said or started to say about his accomplishments, you know, he said, you go to the beach and you don't see oil rigs. And well, a lot of Florida politicians from both parties have fought offshore drilling. But even if you give Nelson credit for being a leader in that. It's hard to point to something that isn't there as an accomplishment. In other words, you know, he's saying, look, you don't see an oil rig. So it's kind of difficult to point for voters to see something that isn't there and you know, credit a politician with that. And then he goes into the space program. And I don't know if he was going to go on before he was interrupted and before Scott turned the focus to term limits. Zach and John, just a quick thought from each of you on what do you think is Senator Nelson's legacy?
Well, I'd go ahead first by saying, you know, I think to a degree, you know, his departure is going to be really, it's somewhat generational. I mean, he was 76, first elected in 1972, and he still carried that, you know, twang of rural Florida, having grown up in a ranch in what was then rural Brevard County, pre-NASA. But maybe more than generational, it's that cultural change, I think. He was defeated by Scott, who's not too distant in age. Scott turned 66 on December 1st. But Scott is a multimillionaire transplant to Florida. He didn't have his roots in Florida like Nelson, who used to visit family grave sites in Washington County, where his ancestors began farming in 1829. It's sort of the end of an era. Maybe Nelson could have done things differently. You know, he ran a very closely controlled campaign against Scott, you know, just making a flurry of small scale campaign appearances, mostly toward the end of the race, instead running a lot of TV ads. And of course, you know, we mentioned the only one debate. And then, of course, President Trump's last weekend before the election appearances in Florida may have cinched it for Scott and for DeSantis. But, you know, Nelson's going to be remembered as the centrist Democrat who really worked his home state issues like NASA funding, fighting offshore oil drilling, securing federal emergency aid following hurricanes. And, you know, he was pretty much a Democrat on issues of education, healthcare, and spending. But he had, but he didn't have too many showcase issues. And his campaign this time around was mostly aimed at anti-Scott, trying to inflame the public against the Republican governor and his record. And in the end, Nelson was a workhorse, and maybe you know, he needed to be more of a show horse this year.
I agree with John. I think in the end, Nelson will be remembered more for sort of what he represents, his approach, his style, than more for any one accomplishment. He's not wrong in saying that, you know, he was a leading advocate for NASA. There's probably no other lawmaker in the country who's more closely identified with NASA. And he's not wrong in saying that, you know, he was a leading advocate for stopping oil drilling off the coast of Florida. But like you said, George, those are kind of things that are, you know, they're not super high profile. You know, but the reality is that there's very few lawmakers who get signature legislation. You know, if you try and think of a bill that's named after a lawmaker, I was just thinking off the top of my head right now, and McCain-Feingold, Dodd-Frank. I mean, it just doesn't happen where you drive through some massive piece of legislation. Usually it's leadership driven, you know, things like the Affordable Care Act or the big tax cut that the Republicans just pushed through, and everybody has some impact on it, but it's really not any one lawmaker who really drove it through. So in a sense, you know, it's kind of an unfair criticism of him. But I think that, you know, really what he will be known for is, like John said, being sort of a different generation, more of an old school blue dog, moderate Democrat, an institutionalist, somebody who could work across the aisle. He worked very well with Marco Rubio. They got along very well. He didn't make politics about trying to destroy the other side. And so I think that's getting rarer and rarer in politics these days.
And another era, not quite the same stature as Bill Nelson, but an important figure in Florida politics in a different way is stepping aside. Sarasota County Republican Chairman Joe Gruters is not going to seek re-election, I guess, as county chairman. And unless you're a real political geek, you probably don't know his name. But Zach Anderson, explain why that's a significant or interesting development in Florida politics.
Yeah, Gruters, you know, it's more about what he represents or what he was able to do that's really kind of interesting. You know, he took over the chair of the Sarasota GOP when he was like 31-year-old aide to Congressman Vern Buchanan. And in the 10 years that he held it, he was really able to get statewide and national attention, most notably because he brought Trump in twice before Trump ran for president. He gave him this sort of made up award, the Sarasota GOP's Statesman of the Year award. But it was, you know, Trump likes, I'm sure, getting awards, and it was enough to lure him here and get some attention for Joe Gruters, for Sarasota County, for Trump. I mean, it was kind of a win-win for all of them. And so it shows what sort of an ambitious chairman can do in terms of getting attention and making a bit of an impact. And Gruters went from being sort of this unknown aide to Vern Buchanan to opening up for Trump at his rallies. I think he's spoke at every one of Trump's rallies in Florida. He was the co-chair of Trump's Florida campaign in 2016. Trump appointed him to the Amtrak board. And then just recently, he won a state House seat and then a state Senate seat. So he used it to advance his own interests, but he also got a lot of attention for this area in particular, and really, you know, kind of was able to bring some pretty high profile people to Florida and kind of spark a conversation and put this area and Florida at the center of the debate as in the run up to the 2016 presidential election, which it already would be. But, you know, he kind of just steered it even more in that direction.
Yeah. If you were thinking of running for president or something, I know Ted Cruz went to Sarasota County, I think, in 2013, Michelle Bachmann, you know, so Gruters was able to get this A-list Republican national figures come speak there. And as you mentioned, Donald Trump, you know, in the run up to running for president, made a couple of appearances there. Well, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty free music playing again. And that means it's time to return to our pick a number segment. So, note takers, you want to bust out your notes? Let's go in. From highest to lowest this week. Zach Anderson, your number was 82. Can you explain that for us, please?
So, 82 is the number of viewer votes that Sarasota County counted when they did their machine recount after this big election, and we went to unprecedented three state races that went to recounts. The first one was a machine recount, and Sarasota County counted 82 fewer votes during this machine recount than during their initial tally. And Sarasota County wasn't the only one that counted fewer votes. Hillsborough County counted 846 fewer votes. Broward County counted 3,500 fewer votes. And that had a lot of people saying, hey, what's going on with these missing votes? I mean, are we going to, you know, this not count some of these votes in the recount? And are there flaws in this recount process if we can't figure out where all these ballots are or the machines are not reading these ballots? So there was a lot of questions about the recount, a lot of criticism, county struggling to meet the timelines and questions about missed deadlines and ballot security. But I think just the mechanics of this and whether or not they're accurately counting these votes a second time around is going to be a big part of the conversation going forward. The supervisors of elections from around the state are going to be meeting in Sarasota starting on Sunday. They had this conference scheduled before the recount, but I think these missing votes, the quality of this recount is going to be one of the things that's discussed along with the timelines and other issues that came up. And I think there'll be a healthy discussion here about kind of where the maybe legislative changes that need to happen to make sure that these recounts go ahead in an effective manner.
Big implications for 2020 there. You're right. Okay, good number. John Kennedy, 39.
39, George, is the number of polls that had Democrat Andrew Gillum leading over now governor-elect Ron DeSantis in the governor's race. That was looking from the August primary until Election Day. That's 39 polls out of 41 that were tracked by the website Real Clear Politics. DeSantis, of course, you know, won the race by 0.4% following a statewide machine recount. That was less than a 33,000 vote margin. The Rick Scott, Bill Nelson race for U.S. Senate was even closer, just over 10,000 votes and a 0.12 percentage point margin. But polls in that race were a little less predictable, although Nelson again was the clear expected leader. Nelson was up by an average 2.4% in the end, and Gillum was up by 3.6%. But, you know, both are within the margin of error in most polls. And so maybe the lesson taken away from this is that these kind of margins are really meaningless. We love to watch the horse race factor of it, but the races are essentially tied, and we in the media maybe do a misservice by touting, you know, one person as leading when they have that kind of margin.
Yep, we'll have to be more responsible, I hope. Although I don't know, I suspect as the 2020 campaign heats up, it's hard to ignore some of those polls. But you are certainly correct there. Well, my number was 38. 38 is the number of days that President Donald Trump went without playing golf between October 14th and November 21st, when he returned to Mar-a-Lago and then played golf while he was here in Palm Beach. And 38 was the longest period he has gone in his presidency without playing golf. A lot of the weekends that he might have been playing in October, he was out at campaign rallies for Republican candidates leading up to the midterm elections. But that was the longest golf drought of the Trump presidency. When he got here, he made up for it by golfing for five straight days when he was in Palm Beach. Chelsea, you had the number 11. Can you explain that one to us, please?
Yes. So 11 is the number of days it took for Andrew Gillum to officially concede in the governor's race. So that would be from November 7th to the 17th.
11 days. Yeah. So I guess I'm trying to recall, did he concede before?
So, yes, he conceded, I believe, the night on election night, but then unconceded and then officially conceded on the 17th, which was Saturday.
Right. And I think Nelson conceded maybe the next day. So, yeah, that's Florida elections are never quite a tidy affair. It always goes a little bit into overtime there. Well, that concludes our podcast here. It has been, as always, an honor to host for you. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. I've been joined here in studio by our special guest, Chelsea Todaro, also from the Palm Beach Post. We've had Don Kennedy, the Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief in Tallahassee, and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson in Sarasota, assisted here in West Palm Beach by Joe Forzano, and as always, the man behind the curtain in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Adam Fish. Thank you.